I'm Nick Dearden, and this is Counterpower, the podcast for global solidarity. Today, we're going to be talking about the issue which has, more than any other, shown the depth of hypocrisy in the international rules-based order, and that's Palestine. In Gaza, the world watched a genocide in real time, war crimes on a massive scale, day after day, for 2 years. Across the world, millions and millions of people protested, marched, and opposed this horror in any way they could. And yet, most of us were ignored. The genocide machine rolled on. And today, those responsible, foremost Israel and the United States, are in charge of a so-called peace process which seems to treat the victims as if they were the aggressors. What's more, Trump's Gaza Peace Board, which will oversee Gaza going forward, could, it's been posited, become a sort of alternate UN, implementing Trump's diktats well beyond Gaza. So, has Israel's genocide broken even the semblance of the international order that was built after the Second World War? And if so, what does that mean for those of us trying to build a better world? Today, I'm going to be interviewing Omar Barghouti, a founder of the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions, or BDS movement, as well as the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel. He's a recipient of the Gandhi Peace Award. Omar Barghouti, welcome to the show. Omar, we first met 20 years ago when Roger Waters of Pink Floyd was planning a tour, and we wanted to make sure he didn't play in Tel Aviv, and got in touch with him. And we brought him to see the wall which was being built in the occupied West Bank. And I think it's fair to say he never looked back in terms of his politics. And much of that is to do with the stories that you were able to tell him about the occupation and what was happening. But at that time, we were in the middle of the Second Intifada, and it felt to me like there was some hope, as bad as it was for people in Palestine across the territories, that this injustice couldn't last forever and that it might get worse for a time. But I felt at the time that within 20 years, things would have improved. And unfortunately, I was very, very wrong. I'm so pleased that you are still doing what you're doing, that you're still such a prominent voice. But where do you find hope on this issue? What gives you strength, given the horrific events that we've lived through in the last couple of years?
Thanks for this important question, because indeed it's a very important part of what we do. And it's not an artificial or forced kind of hope. It's a real organic hope that stems from our daily work with so many people across the world. The network that we work with includes millions and millions of people. And from the smallest little initiatives in a tiny little village, in a school, to the biggest trade unions and so on, we're seeing so much hope in the solidarity. People are finally getting that solidarity means ending complicity first and foremost, and they're doing something about it. But the most important source of hope, for me at least, comes from our own people. The Palestinian incredible ability to resist and to exist despite the genocide, the resilience, the sumud or steadfastness of our people, especially the young people, especially the children, has been beyond inspiring. In the face of all this, it always reminds me that I can never give up hope. I have no right to give up hope.
It's so powerful. And I mean, I feel the same, you know, through speaking to people like you. If you can keep going in this situation, I have no right to give up. It's incredible that there is now a whole generation of Palestinians who've been born, even since we came over with Roger. And like you say, the resilience is just absolutely, absolutely extraordinary. Could you tell us, maybe we had a lot of information about what was going on in Gaza, not all of it true, but nonetheless, it did dominate the news for the 2 years that the full-scale assault was taking place. It has now dropped right out of the news, but we know, of course, the killings continue. Could you tell us a little bit about what's happening in Gaza now? Has the so-called ceasefire made any difference at all to people?
Very little, because Israel's, we call it the U.S.-Israeli genocide, really, because it's they're complete partners. This U.S.-Israeli genocide perpetrated by the Israeli state and military, supported by the almost the entirety of Israeli society, continues in less visible forms, in less intense forms, if you will. But the starvation continues. The prevention of medical aid continues. The occupation continues. The siege, the ethnic cleansing, the total devastation of everything that can sustain life in Gaza continues. Because Israel is preventing anything from going in for people, even proper tents to protect people from the cold or from the rain. They're preventing that. So the genocide continues in less visible forms. And the whole design, the whole plan was it would move off the screens of people so that the U.S. and Israel can avoid the worst forms of sanctions and accountability, because then very few people will be talking about the genocide. But to their surprise, we have not seen any decrease in solidarity, in fact, because from the beginning, people did not rely on the BBCs or the CNNs of the world, because those were complicit to begin with. They were genocidal to begin with. They were with the oppressor, not related to the oppressed. People relied on their live stream, on social media, and independent sources, and those have continued to expose the daily killings until today, the ongoing genocide. And this has meant that trade unions in Italy continue to hold strikes in support of Palestine, in support of Gaza. The largest trade union, Federation of Ireland, is becoming an apartheid-free zone. In dock workers' unions in Turkey and Belgium and France and Spain and Morocco and so on are continuing with amazing courage to block military aid, military supplies to Israel, and so on and so forth. There are a million examples of meaningful, serious solidarity continuing. So people are not buying it, that the genocide is over, now let's move on to some peace. It's the peace of surrender. It's the peace of a new face of colonialism.
I mean, it's really good to hear that those solidarity movements are not stopping. And even I think the pressure on European governments is still absolutely immense. And so there are countries, even like Belgium, which are still threatening. I mean, we should be a long way past threatening trade sanctions at this point, but nonetheless, they are still under pressure. And I think, you know, it's interesting as well, isn't it? I mean, when we met 20 years ago, we didn't really have social media in any form that we would recognize it today. And we complain a lot about who owns social media and the way the algorithms work. And there are lots of problems there. But there is one positive, and that is that it does allow the Palestinians to get their messages out directly to the world. And that is, from everything we can see, continuing. And so people must absolutely not turn away simply because Israel has declared a ceasefire. Do you know what the situation's like with, I know there's lots of problems with some of the aid agencies, which Israel is trying to effectively make illegal now. Journalists are able to get into to Gaza now?
No, still
not.
No, humanitarian aid is not allowed. Journalists are not allowed. Some UN agencies are not allowed. Some UN officials are not allowed. UN special rapporteurs, human rights experts are not allowed, and so on and so forth. Even Western NGOs are now being restricted like never before.
And of course, what a lot of people don't realize, if they don't understand the situation, is you're not allowed. Right? Most Palestinians are also not allowed.
Yeah, everyone is not allowed. No Palestinians are allowed, except if you work with the Red Crescent and you've passed every security check there is and so on.
And the number of people, of course, on the West Bank or within the 48 borders who have family in Gaza and have been watching in the same way that we've been watching all of this on the TV is absolutely horrifying. Yeah. And so it is a trauma that's been experienced by Palestinians as a whole, not just those who are in Gaza itself. Tell us a little bit, because what we heard less about when the genocide was going on was what was going on the occupied West Bank. But as I understand it, Israel used the genocide in Gaza as a cover to continue its operations on the occupied West Bank and make life much more difficult for that. And that, I believe, tell me if I'm wrong, has intensified since the supposed ceasefire.
Yes, Yes, Israel's brutality in the West Bank is unprecedented since 1967. As UN Special Rapporteur Francesca Albanese has very meticulously documented in her reports, Israel used the genocide in Gaza against our people there as a cover, as a smokescreen to escalate its ethnic cleansing of indigenous Palestinians in the West Bank like never before. Village after village, town after town, everywhere across the West Bank, no one is safe anymore. In cities and villages and refugee camps, especially refugee camps, I think this was the plan all along, that Israel would want to eliminate refugee camps, thinking that if we physically destroy the refugee camps in the West Bank, as they've done with several refugee camps in Jenin, in Tul Karim, in the north of the West Bank, that we will end the plight of Palestinian refugees. They will stop demanding their UN-stipulated and inherent right to return to their homeland, like all other refugees. But the Zionist movement and Israel as a settler colony since 1948 have tried indigenous Palestinians, and they should know by now, but apparently they're a bit thick when it comes to this issue, or maybe wishful thinking, that we will forget. We won't forget. We haven't forgotten. Small children in refugee camps in Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Jenin, Lida in 48, refugees in Haifa, remember where their ancestors came from, where their fathers and grandparents and mothers came from. And they remember that we have a right to return, and we shall continue until we return. So, but Israel has definitely tried to erase several refugee camps. They're continuing. And they're trying as much as possible to hit the most vulnerable Palestinian isolated communities in the West Bank, in the Jordan Valley, one of the most fertile land, the pieces of land in the West Bank. They're evacuating Palestinians. They're erasing Palestinian presence. Settlers are now openly, with the support of the military, killing, abducting, injuring, terrorizing, burning houses. Just hours ago, last night, they burnt a mosque in Nablus. They just walked in, burnt a mosque in Nablus, and walked out, completely supported by the Israeli military. They injure people, they shoot at children. It is just horrific what's happening in the West Bank, even by Israeli standards, as far as the West Bank is concerned. It doesn't compare to Gaza, obviously. Genocide is the crime of crimes. But this is unprecedented in the West Bank.
And there's very little information that gets out about this. Right? I mean, I remember many years ago going to the Jordan Valley, and it was a real eye-opener, because this is where Israel has many of their farms, illegally, of course, where they produce the fruit and vegetables that appear in European shops, in all of our supermarkets. And it's only when you get there that you realize what violence is built into all of those fruit and vegetables. It is literally built on the theft of land, on the theft of water, on making the lives of Palestinians unbearable so that they leave and go somewhere else.
Even rainwater. Palestinian farmers are denied their natural human right to collect rainwater in cisterns, in tanks. You're not allowed. Israel considers rainwater that falls on the occupied Palestinian territory as its own property. So if you dig some well and use this water, you're stealing the water of the Israeli state, which is the occupying, illegal occupying power, as the International Court of Justice has said since 2024. It is illegal. The entire occupation is illegal. Yet even rainwater. So that they're thirsting people. As they're starving people in Gaza, they're thirsting people in the West Bank. They're making access to water nearly impossible in certain areas as a tool of ethnic cleansing.
Before we go to the break, Omar, I wonder if we could just say something about the political prisoners, because again, it's something that got raised in the genocide. I think before that, people didn't know much about it. It wasn't talked about a lot. But the number of Palestinian political prisoners. I mean, people who've effectively been kidnapped, some of them children, many of them tortured, die, and so on. What's the situation facing political prisoners on the West Bank now?
I'm so glad you asked this, because the situation of Palestinian prisoners, including almost all political prisoners, has been unprecedented in its horror. The depravity with which the Israeli prison authorities, detention center guards, and so on are dealing with Palestinian prisoners, we've never seen anything like this since 1967. Because now the violence, including sexual violence, and the immense brutality, the starvation or near starvation of prisoners is becoming policy. Because the minister responsible for the police is a fascist. And he's part of a whole fascist government. And he took it upon himself to make sure that every single Palestinian prisoner is tortured and deprived of basic rights under international law. And unfortunately, the Red Cross is doing next to nothing to raise the issue of how Israel is systematically, by policy, not by accident, starving Palestinian prisoners, torturing them every single day. Now, luckily, we do have UN reports that have documented this torture. We have Palestinian human rights organizations and international human rights organizations that have documented this unbelievable level of torture, including against Palestinian children, child detainees, kidnapped from Gaza, kidnapped from the West Bank, from their homes at 2 a.m. in the morning. They just pick them from their bed and take them. This has been going on for years, but it has never been this brutal as we're seeing it today.
Thank you, Omar. We're going to go for a break now. I think what you've told us is utterly horrifying, but we need to know what's going on, because it is only that that's going to continue mobilizing the action that can bring this horror to an end. We'll be back in a few minutes.
Hi there. I'm Alyssa Elliott. Some say we're entering a new age of hard power, where might makes right and despots carve up the world between them. Here on Counterpower, we've got other ideas. As the tyrants face rising resistance, join us to analyze the forces shaping our world and the actions we can take to win real change. The podcast is brought to you by Stop Trump Coalition, Another Europe is Possible, and Global Justice Now, three organizations at the center of the new global resistance. Counterpower isn't just about chatting and conversation, as great as that is. It's about turning ideas into action and building real community power. That's why we have a simple pledge to you, our audience. On every single episode, we'll leave you with something you can do, big or small, to catalyze change. Whether it's the latest big ideas or the movements you need to check out, you'll find them on Counterpower. But we need your help to do all this. We know this podcast has great promise, but to get it off the ground, we need your support. That's why we're aiming to raise £8,000 to kick off this exciting project. To support our launch, please hit the link in the show notes. And don't forget to like, follow, and subscribe so you never miss an episode. And if you like what you hear, please leave us a positive review. Now, back to the podcast.
And we're back. Omar, I'd like us to take in this section a step back from the immediacy of the horror facing the Palestinians. At the start of the year, European leaders seemed actually taken aback by Trump's threats against Greenland. You got the impression that in Western Europe, suddenly politicians were saying, well, maybe this guy is serious. But it seems to me that any semblance of international order had already broken down over Gaza. Anybody who was watching what had happened in Gaza could no longer believe seriously there was any international rules-based order left. Therefore, I want to ask, do you see what happened in Gaza as some sort of turning point in the world where finally ordinary people had their eyes open to what international law really means or doesn't mean? And if so, what does that say about the world order or disorder we're heading into now?
Well, I think, as President Gustavo Petro of Colombia said as far back as October 23, days after the beginning of the genocide, he said, Gaza is only the first experiment to consider all of us disposable. So he used the term experiment, and then several people used it after him, that if those who think Gaza, what's happening in Gaza, will stop there, are dead wrong. What is meant by that? What is so different about this genocide? It's the world's first live stream genocide. That makes it absolutely unique. No other genocide in history has been live streamed. This is the first time. Even genocide committed by the United States, by European powers, have never been advertised and live streamed. It's always secretive, undercover, and so on. This is the first time. Now, the Western colonial establishment, with Israel at its lead in this case, is perpetrating this live stream genocide, testing new weapons, testing new digital weapons, as in artificial intelligence and cloud technologies, weaponizing them, using them as digital weapons. So there's a lot of complicity, not just from states, but from corporations, as well as institutions, of course. This has all been the context in which Trump's so-called Donroe Doctrine has evolved. Even the United States, as I said, has never dared to invade a country like it has done with Venezuela without the pretense of human rights, democracy, whatever. Now it's very open. You have riches and resources that we need, and we want them. And that's the end of the story. Greenland, same story. The people of Greenland do not matter to the United States empire. We need your riches, we need your strategic resources, and we want to get it, and that's the end of the story. So many in the West, in Europe, have waken up to this fact that this U.S. empire is not stopping at any red lights. There is no red light. As Craig Mochaibar, former senior UN human rights official, said, in a world where even genocide is not a red line, there are no red lights. There are no red lights. Now, when you hear the president of France saying that this is a new form of colonialism and imperialism, whenever you hear a French president talking about imperialism and colonialism, you know something is deeply wrong in this Western-dominated world. The prime minister of Belgium warned about slavery with no sense of irony about Belgium's history in Africa and so on. So when Western colonial leaders talk about slavery, empire, imperialism, and so on, you know something is deeply wrong. But all of them have played a role in leading us to this moment. All of them have been complicit in the genocide in Gaza. And that was the beginning of the end of this international law order that has existed since World War II. Of course, it was never perfect. There was Vietnam, and there were so many atrocities across the world. There was Iraq and Afghanistan and so on and so forth. And Latin America, of course. But we've never been in such a might makes right era like we are today since World War II. It's openly might makes right. And this, Israel was the leader of that move towards a might makes right order with full partnership of the United States, government, companies, tech giants, oligarchs, and so on and so forth. So all of those European powers have been complicit, and they have themselves to blame for bringing the world to the brink of a possible nuclear war even. This is no longer some alarmist prediction. This could happen from Ukraine and so on. So I think it's a very serious moment we're living. Is it an irreversible trend in the West? Unfortunately not, because this very savage capitalism that has taken over the West is not giving up anytime soon. Presidents and prime ministers are not as powerful as those tech oligarchs and military industry and oil industry oligarchs and the banking industry and so on. So it's a very complex system, but it's being exposed. It's really losing its masks and being exposed to the global majority. And that's the silver lining in all of this.
I agree. And I'm really pleased you brought up the tech question, actually. We're doing a lot more work on big tech and the power of these robber barons now. But I think a lot of people, you know, take my own country here in Britain, a lot of people were just perplexed as to why any government, never mind a supposed center-left government, continued to give cover, continued to sell arms, continued to negotiate trade and give its full political and diplomatic support to Israel when they could see a genocide happening. And it was hard to explain to some degree, right? I mean, people like me have always believed if only enough people thought this is wrong, if only enough people could see the injustice, it would change. And yet on Gaza, it didn't change the minds of our politicians, even though most people. And so I wonder why. And it seems to me this idea that Israel is at the cutting edge of testing high-tech forms of population control, high-tech forms of military. I mean, this is the thing that our government wanted a bit of, right? And that was why it continued to negotiate until really very late, a trade deal which had tech right at the center of it.
There's this factor, obviously, that Israel is at the forefront of field testing advanced weaponry, including digital weapons, as I said, tech weapons against the Palestinians, then that can then be used by the colonial West against migrant communities, against racialized communities, the unwanted, basically, the disposables, if you will. But there are other factors. So there is definitely this corporate capture of governments, if you will. But there's also a lot of other factors, I think. There's colonial affinity. Britain, France, the Netherlands, Spain, they've been there. They for 500 years, they have committed horrific genocides in the world, from the Americas to Australia to Africa, Latin America, Asia, across the world. They know what they've done in the past. So to them, Israel is part of the family. It's our settler colony. We created it, and we've done almost the same thing that they've done. You know, Germany, Britain, they've all done something very similar. Yes, in the past, but we can't blame Israel now. It's part of the family. So there is this kind of colonial affinity. And thanks to the Epstein horror and criminality, now we know there are other factors as well. There are human factors that people tend to ignore sometimes. There's a level of corruption in the colonial West that is unprecedented. Even a country like Britain, which used to pride itself for being so democratic, now we know better. Now we know who runs the show in the UK. All those oligarchs and businesses, and the, they tell government what needs to be done, and they cut deals with Palantir, despite all what Palantir has done and is doing. The UK is giving hundreds of millions of pounds to Palantir. So there's a level of corruption that is unprecedented across the colonial West, with very few exceptions, from Norway to Britain, from the US to France to Germany, everywhere. There's unbelievable level of corruption. And there's this white, powerful business people and politicians who are engaged in the most depraved, horrific crimes. And they benefit each other, and they have their network where they exchange benefits and interests.
Absolutely. So there is a collapse of the established order, not just internationally, but of course that's affecting us here in Britain and in many countries across the world as well. What role do you see? So we saw some horrible images coming out of Trump's meeting of his Gaza so-called peace board over the weekend, the head of FIFA there in his MAGA cap, war criminal Tony Blair. I mean, this whole board is made up of oligarchs and Zionists, exactly the people that you've been talking about. I find it extraordinary that the victims of a genocide through this peace board are almost being treated as if they were the perpetrator of these war crimes. What do you think the peace board and what it's going to attempt to do in Gaza? Do you think it will be able to have any success? Will the resistance continue amongst the people of Gaza, who must be so desperate at this point for the basics of life to resume?
Well, no one expects this so-called Board of Peace to bring any goodies to the Palestinians or our basic rights. From the very beginning, it never mentioned Palestinians or our rights. Our right to self-determination, our United Nations stipulated rights were never mentioned from the beginning in their original charter. What the Trump administration and the oligarchs around it are trying to do is to establish an alternative to the United Nations. And the fascist U.S. ambassador to Israel, who might as well be Israel's ambassador to Israel, has said it. He said the quiet part out loud. We need to destroy the ICJ and the ICC and so on, because otherwise they'll hold our president accountable, and they'll hold, you know, the Western leaders accountable for their what they've done. So he knows what they've done. So they're openly undermining the United Nations like never before. Since the UN was established, And it was initially a very U.S.-dominated initiative to establish the UN. People forget the San Francisco Conference and so on. Now, the U.S. and Israel are destroying the United Nations, no less. So this Board of Peace is a new way of adjudicating conflicts, if you will, by the emperor, the self-appointed emperor of the world, supported by Israel and many networks of power in the United States and elsewhere.
Absolutely. And so from the horror that we've seen in Gaza comes the unraveling, really, of the whole world order. Trump is now using it, as you say, I think, to supplant the United Nations and create an alternative form of international cooperation based upon the rule of the bully.
But that's a sign of weakness to me. It doesn't project power as much as it projects decline, the beginning of the unraveling of the decline of empire, rather than show, because this empire always used soft power, the music industry and the film industry and you know, the U.S. Heaven that many youth around the world wanted to migrate to the United States, the land of opportunity, that is so gone today. No one has a dream of going to the U.S. It has become a nightmare. You cannot reverse that easily.
Yes. No, I agree. It is a very different world, and we now have to, as ordinary people across the world, come together to fight for something more just. Just as Trump is using this moment to try to reorder the world order around the rule of the bully. But I really agree.
Our agency is everything. I mean, nothing will come from the divine, from the skies.
Yes.
It won't unravel by itself. We need to resist empire collectively. Preferably nonviolently, in my view, in the most morally consistent way, where we uphold everyone's rights, everyone's dignity, and we uphold international law.
Yeah, great. Thank you. We're going to come back for our final section for some hope and what people can do about all of this. Let's just take a break now.
Okay.
Hey there, I'm Max Hammer. I work as a human rights campaigner, and for the past 2.5 years, I've also been a spokesperson and communications lead for an organization in the UK called NAMOD. We're a movement of UK-based Jews that seek to mobilize our community to play a role in supporting a struggle for freedom, justice, and equality for all Palestinians and Israelis living between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. And for about 7 years now, we've been campaigning against institutions in our community that support Israel's systems of occupation and apartheid, and especially in the past 2.5 years, have been working to end support for Israel's ongoing genocide in Gaza. And we use a wide range of campaign tactics to try and reach these goals. So we've helped shape Jewish participation in this mass protest movement for Palestinian freedom here in the UK. We've also disrupted and opposed Jewish community events that provide cover for the Israeli state and its racist politicians. And we have led a series of rallies, protests, occupations, and marches outside government offices to loudly combat the government's criminal support for Israel's genocide. Recently, in particular, we have been working on a number of campaigns, including to strengthen progressive Jewish student movements here in the UK, to end community ties to settler violence in Palestine, and to confront institutions in our community that provide cover to far-right politicians both in Israel and in the UK. If you're interested in that last area of work, make sure to find us at the Together March Against the Far Right on March 28th in London. And you can also find us on Instagram and Blue Sky at NAMOD UK, that's NAAMODUK, and on our website at namod.org.uk to sign up. Hope to see you soon.
So we're back. I'm interviewing Omar Barghouti, a really inspirational Palestinian activist. And I was going to ask you for some hope in this section, but I think you've been giving us quite a bit of hope, based in realism, of course, throughout the whole interview. But you are one of the founders of the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions movement. That movement has gained considerable prominence over the period that the genocide was taking place, unsurprisingly. We now need to sustain that movement, even with Palestine less in the news. Could you tell us a little bit about BDS and its evolution, where it's come from, how it's got to this stage, and where you're hoping it will go now?
Yes, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, or BDS movement, was launched in 2005 by the absolute majority of Palestinian society within historic Palestine, as well as in exile. So the refugee communities also played a role in launching the BDS movement, inspired by the South African anti-apartheid struggle and the U.S. civil rights movement, among others. BDS called for ending Israel's occupation and its system of apartheid against the entirety of indigenous Palestinians, but also for the right of return and reparations for Palestinian refugees, which is the most important part, given that the absolute majority of Palestinians are refugees, external refugees or internal refugees. From the beginning, the BDS movement, as a matter of principle, is not just a nonviolent movement, but an anti-racist movement. It connects the struggle for Palestinian liberation with other justice struggles, racial justice, climate justice, social justice, gender justice, and so on and so forth. So we've managed over the last two decades, since 2005, in building this massive network of allies and partners with tens of millions of people in those unions and organizations and mass movements that are our partners. And this has all played a role in achieving the impact that the movement has achieved. Since 2014, approximately, the Israeli regime of settler colonialism, apartheid, and military occupation started to view BDS as a strategic threat, and then as an existential threat. They use this term, which is really strange for a nonviolent movement abiding by international law and human rights principles to be considered by a nuclear power like Israel, a savage settler colonial regime, as an existential threat, no less. Why? Because as one Israeli general said in a different context, we don't do Gandhi very well. They have nuclear weapons, but they don't know what to do with a movement that is nonviolent, anti-racist, and is connected with all those progressive movements worldwide. Indeed, we know that for a fact. They don't do Gandhi very well. They don't know how to deal except with tanks and jets and massive weapons and so on. So the BDS movement, in a nutshell, has managed to achieve not just massive boycotts of companies that are complicit, massive academic, cultural, sports boycotts, but has also started, especially during the genocide, to affect a policy change in many governments around the world. And this is completely new. For example, pre-genocide, we had zero countries supporting a military embargo of Israel. During the genocide and until now, more than 50 countries have signed on, at least theoretically, to supporting a military embargo of Israel. Some countries have really taken action, like Colombia, preventing its coal from being exported to Israel and preventing and stopping the import of Israeli weapons. Turkey banned a lot of the trade with Israel. Malaysia banned ships carrying weapons to Israel, and so on and so forth. There are many, many, many examples, from states to trade unions to universities that have cut ties with Israeli complicit universities, thanks mainly to student mobilizations and academics mobilizations, artists' unions. Thousands, tens of thousands of artists, writers, filmmakers, musicians have joined the cultural boycott. The most recent success was in Hollywood. About 5,500 film artists, mostly from Hollywood, have pledged not to work with complicit Israeli festivals and film institutions.
In the Netherlands, that's fantastic, Omar. I didn't know about that. 5,000, you said?
5,500.
And that's incredible.
It's increasing, and including A-listers like Oscar winners and some of the top names in Hollywood, including some very prominent Jewish stars. And this must be said, because throughout this, Israel is trying to portray, to conflate opposition to its genocide, apartheid, and settler colonialism as if it's anti-Jewish somehow. But the BDS movement from the beginning had a very strong Jewish component, especially in the United States, in the UK, in South Africa, and other countries. Young Jewish people are coming to BDS in numbers that we've never seen before. Just look at the United States, where it counts the most, where Jewish Voice for Peace and in Canada, Independent Jewish Voices have been quadrupling in size every few months. It's just unbelievable, the support for BDS among younger Jewish persons. So, and we're seeing also pension funds like the Norwegian sovereign fund, the largest in the world, divesting from companies and from Israel bonds because of the involvement, the complicity in violating Palestinian rights. But also in Luxembourg, Netherlands, New Zealand, and elsewhere, some major corporations have been forced due to BDS pressure to abandon their business in Israel. Co-op supermarket chain in the UK has decided to boycott Israeli products thanks to the massive vote by its members. In addition to all this, some savvy investors have started to pull out of Israel, not because of moral or legal reasons. It is a moral obligation and a legal obligation to pull out, but because of fiduciary economic reasons. They can see what's happening with the Israeli state, the nosediving tech industry, what 130 top Israeli economists have called a spiral of collapse. And this is never mentioned in the West. The Financial Times and the New York Times will never tell you that 130 top Israeli economists have warned as early as 2024 of a spiral of collapse. And it's a whole theory that they explain. So investors are starting to see that. What does BDS have to do with this? Well, the chairman of the Israel Export Institute admits, quote, BDS and boycotts have changed Israel's global trade landscape, end of quote. So this is what BDS is about. It's not just the Coca-Cola and the McDonald's and the Carrefour and this company. That's what people think BDS is all about. It's much, much, much larger than that. I'll finally end with one success story that's really inspiring. The BDS movement with our partners across the world, especially in Europe, has succeeded in getting Israel completely out of at least one sport, cycling. Israel no longer competes in international cycling. It's out. The team that they have established with millions and millions of dollars spent decided they no longer want to represent Israel because they cannot compete anywhere without massive nonviolent disruptions. In Spain, in Italy, in France, everywhere, they're facing mass demonstrations, especially in the Spanish state. So I'll just end with that example of the impact.
It's great. And do you know, I didn't know about it, but there's a cycling enthusiast here in our office who works in our resources team. And he did a whole presentation to the staff about what happened because he was so excited with what happened with that cycling story. And I think it's really important that people recognize this as a step forward because all of us feel the weight of what has happened, our inability to fundamentally change what our government's approach was towards Israel in this. But this is going on beneath the surface. And, you know, I always say to people, the anti-apartheid movement was founded in London in 1950. It took a very, very long time. These things take a long time, unfortunately. But when you look at BDS, it has grown beyond belief, really. And it seems to me, you know, I think particularly over the genocide, the attitude of a lot of young Americans towards Israel seems to have profoundly changed.
Absolutely.
And that, you know, it seems to me they're not going to forget the struggles that they've been in, the repression they faced for expressing their horror at a genocide. And also, as you said, there's always been a large Jewish component in Palestinian solidarity, but really it's exploded now. I mean the number of young Jewish people in British society who cannot identify any longer with this state is enormous. And so I suppose I wanted to ask you there whether you think that's a permanent change. I don't see how that would be reversed. But if I was a serious thinker in Israel, wondering about the long-term sustainability and viability of this state, I would be seriously worried.
Well, the Israeli fascist prime minister, not too long ago, he said, we're getting isolated and we need to think of ourselves as a super Sparta. Super Sparta, as in relying totally on itself, does not need the rest of the world. And even His Majesty the Emperor Trump, when addressing the Knesset a few months ago, the Israeli parliament, said, and I have his quote here somewhere. Yes, he said, in his unbelievable eloquence, as always, it was getting to be a little nasty out there in the world for Israel. And ultimately, the world wins. You can't beat the world, said Trump. And this world is us, is all of us, those who have collectively, strategically campaigned to end Israel's genocide. They, Netanyahu, Trump, and their ilk, are recognizing what we have achieved. So they know that we've isolated this regime of genocide like never before. Now we need to take it to the next level. The key underpinning philosophical foundation for BDS is that solidarity begins with ending complicity. Because some people think of solidarity as some act of charity. You know, I have some spare time. Maybe I'm a retired teacher. I want to do something useful, so I will stand in solidarity with Palestine. That's wonderful. We appreciate it. But first and foremost, solidarity begins with ending complicity. And everyone is part of something, a union, an institution, and a community, something where I can start with my circle of relative influence, sphere of relative influence, to end complicity. If it's through procurement, not to buy from complicit companies, not to invest in complicit companies, to push city councils to become more ethical and to stop doing business with those companies, and so on. In every kind of context, there's something to be done to end complicity and uphold international law. As people should realize by now, after Venezuela, Cuba, and Greenland, it's not just about Palestinians. It's about humanity. Those who have been standing on the sideline and saying, well, I really feel for the Palestinians, but there's nothing I can do, now should really rethink their position. Silence is complicity. There is no sideline. We either collectively save humanity, or we're all going down the spiral to hell on earth.
Yes, it reminds me of that poster from the Spanish Civil War. If you tolerate this, then your children will be next. And I think that's what we can see now. When you see what Trump is doing on the streets of Minnesota, where you see what happened in Venezuela, where you see the threats against Greenland, we can all see that our future is bound up in whether we can achieve justice in this situation or not.
And what Palantir, Microsoft, Google, Amazon, Oracle have tested against Palestinians during this genocide, they will use in Minneapolis and Houston and London and Paris and everywhere else.
Yeah. Omar, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Do you have any final words that you'd like to give to listeners here?
Just never give up hope. We need to keep going.
Thank you so much. You've been so eloquent as always. You've given me so much inspiration. We will not give up. And I look forward to the next time we speak. Thank you.
Thank you.